Well, thank you, Leslie, and thanks for joining this afternoon. Charles and I will be doing a bit of a tag team act during this presentation, so we'll probably present for around about 25 minutes, I'd say, if we can get through at a reasonable clip. We'd certainly like to leave at least half the session for people to be able to contribute in the areas that Leslie mentioned. But I think also if there's particular points or questions you want to ask on the way through, feel free. Now, I think this session is billed in the program as being actuaries in the community and linked to the leadership initiative. The main focus this afternoon is actually going to be on actuaries in the community. Just to cover the link to the leadership initiative, that's in an advanced stage of development, but there's still a bit of tweaking we're doing with the Institute Leadership Initiative, which needs to be signed off by council, so I'm not going to spend too much time on that this afternoon. Suffice to say, part of the concept that we have in the Leadership Initiative is the opportunity for people to work in sort of an accelerated development program, part of which would involve working on some specific projects, and it's expected that in many cases those projects might actually end up being community-related as part of that development program for individuals. So that's the linkage. The intention this afternoon is really just to exemplify, I guess, some areas where actuaries are making a valuable contribution and to get the discussion going. So in terms of areas where actuaries are making a valuable social contribution, that occurs in a number of ways. It can be through organisations and the very valuable social equity role that organisations play. So if you think of insurance companies, wealth management companies, banks, they do play a useful social equity role in many cases, and actuaries help in that regard. Actuaries contribute through the community and through NGOs and through involvement in public policy. So our aim this afternoon is to highlight some case examples where those contributions are being made, highlight a few areas where we think there's opportunities for further contribution, and hopefully encourage some good discussion in terms of your contributions. Quick background, if you think about the actuarial profession, it did emerge alongside organisations which were designed to help people deal with life's uncertainties. You just need to go back to the origins of the profession, and the friendly society movement and the social role of friendly societies to think about how the profession has actually evolved. So that's actually part of our genes, if you like. So a key part of our essence is awareness of and obligation to the public interest. And when we thought through this exercise, I guess we thought, well, perhaps in more recent years, with all the issues that one needs to deal with, perhaps there's been a diminution of actuaries thinking about their social contribution role. A lot of the focus goes on to commercial realities and delivering for organisations and commercial issues. We think perhaps there's been a potential diminution, and we'd like to sort of try and hopefully shift the balance through this discussion. There are lots of benefits to actuaries being involved from this wider involvement, and I might just lead off these introductory remarks with a quote from an actuary called Brian Risdale, who presented to the 2002 Healthcare Conference on Actuaries and Social Policy. And in that he said, and I quote, "A catalyst in a chemical process is a substance that increases the rate of chemical reaction without itself suffering any permanent chemical change. I believe we should not underestimate the role that the profession can play as a catalyst for thinking about social change. But that is only half the story. By becoming involved in the debates and decisions on our changing environment, we become more able to change ourselves and the way we operate. This too will bring benefit to the profession." So that's the context. I'll hand over to Charles in terms of a bit more background.
Thank you, Andrew. Good afternoon, everyone. So what does community service actually mean? Well, in a way, it was something that we found quite hard to define in a specific sense. The boundaries of it, I think, are quite fluid and open. I think community service is something that you know when you see it. It's when, you know, someone's actually done a piece of activity and you can sense that it has a strong value to the community that the actuary is serving directly. In a way, as actuaries, perhaps more than many other people in society, I think we're very privileged to be able to find time and we have expertise to help communities in ways that other people perhaps can't. The sense of community service that we're really trying to identify is perhaps more when you step out of your normal day job. you're doing something a little bit different from what you're doing in terms of your earning a livelihood. Perhaps, and this may be something that is worth discussing later, it's when you find yourself actually working closer to the coalface of helping people. You know, many of us, when we do things, are actually comparatively remote from the ultimate beneficiaries of what we're doing. But clearly it could still be with the current employer or current organisation, and not precious about being either in that way or not. And you know, that links a little bit to whether it is done with or without remuneration too. But obvious candidates for some areas of involvement are with public policy. Many people may well have been involved through their organisations in submissions, but a number of people will have done it as individuals in their own right, putting their own personal view forward. Working with smaller organisations, not-for-profits and charities, is another obvious area. And especially perhaps in New Zealand, but I'm sure here in Australia as well, smaller groups, family groups, and small sort of indigenous peoples, iwi, are areas of candidacy for helping smaller groups. And in New Zealand, with matrimonial property, sometimes actuaries have helped, you know, sort of inside small families. But I think the important thing is that there are, and we'll touch on some of them, some great examples around working in climate change, forestry valuation, catastrophe, regulation even, and that's the way we should start to look at the examples and work out how we can spread this more widely. So, Andrew, back to you.
So we would certainly submit that making a significant community contribution, it's certainly worthwhile, it's exciting, and it can be very personally fulfilling. I think there's two dimensions to this involvement in terms of being involved in the community and the benefits which can be derived. First and foremost, we focus on the contribution that we can make. There's areas which we might be passionate about, where we've got some relevant capability, we can involved, and we can help make a difference, usually in conjunction with a team of other people. But we get involved because we can make a difference. And there's many examples where individuals have achieved significant things through their endeavours, and we'll go through some of those. But secondly, the second dimension, and it's not the initial motivating driver, but that participation actually does generate significant personal fulfilment for those who get involved. So if I just touch on a couple of those aspects. On the first aspect, one of my favourite authors, if you like, especially on leadership-related issues, is a guy called Robert Greenleaf, wrote a book called Servant Leadership. And in that book he asserts that, I quote, "Caring for persons, the more able and less able serving each other, is the rock upon which a good society is built. Whereas until recently, caring was largely person to person, now much of it is intermediated through institutions. If a better society is to be built, then the most open course is to raise both the capacity to serve and the very performance as servant of existing major institutions by new regenerative forces operating within." So if just a limited number of institutions, and whether that's financial organisations, NFPs, NGOs, can serve with distinction, then the quality of society can and does improve. And as actuaries, that's one of the best ways where we can make a contribution. It's working through some of those organisations and lifting the capacity to serve and the outputs that they produce. That's how we can make a difference. But let's just pause for a moment and say, well, what's the WIFM? The what's in it for me? So the altruistic nature is rewarding, but just touching on that a bit more, I think it's relevant to mention here a group called the Williamson Leadership Foundation in Victoria. It's been running community-based leadership programs for over 20 years, typically involving senior managers and typically doing extremely good things in the community, working on particular projects. The feedback from the participants in the program is invariably that this has been a life-changing event for them, which gives them new levels of insight and deep compassion for others that was way beyond their highest expectations. The value to individuals is reflected then in their leadership capacity and their appreciation and regard for others, and it basically just makes them much more holistic individuals and much better to make a contribution going forward. So that's the feedback from the Williamson Leadership Foundation. The other one which I'll mention here is Clive Hamilton, who's the Executive Director of the Australia Institute. They've done lots of studies about personal happiness and fulfilment, which, after all, is one of the important things in life. And one of their findings was, you know, for example, beyond a certain point, material wealth doesn't generate happiness for you. You know, there's a sufficiency threshold, but beyond that, extra wealth doesn't actually generate personal fulfillment and happiness. What they did find is that a sense of meaning and purpose is the single most important attribute associated with life satisfaction. And in some of these areas, that's what involvement does offer. We're now going to go through some case examples fairly quickly, so we've got time for discussion. The first one, which is covered in the paper, is the area of microinsurance, or microfinance and microinsurance. Micro-enterprise development and microcredit have been part of the development aid framework for at least 30 years now. That's primarily been focused around micro-loans, and its profile increased dramatically probably in 2006 when Muhammad Yunus won the Nobel Peace Prize for the efforts of the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh with microfinance. Now, a more recent development in the area of microfinance is actually microinsurance, which is essentially low-cost insurance for low-income people. It's usually provided by NGOs in conjunction with an insurance company, and it started very much as sort of loan protection arrangements. And there's a range of actuaries who've been significantly involved in this, including through CGAP, which is sort of a consortium under the auspices of the World Bank in terms of encouraging the development of microfinance. So that includes people like Dennis Garand and John Whitf in Canada and a guy called Francois Xavier Hay. And they've been working on developing tools and guides for those involved in microfinance. The microinsurance products themselves, most of them are pretty simple, very simple, and short tail, term life, crop insurance, health insurance. And in the area of health insurance, for example, a lot of the options that we take for granted, deductibles, direct to hospital payments and the like, those features are just evolving, and this is where actuaries can make a really valuable contribution around product design and developing robust health systems. In some cases, it's also complemented with some ancillary services around advice and support. So, for example, in the area of crop insurance, that might involve assisting with things like warehousing arrangements so you can optimise time to market to improve returns for people involved in that area. Sort of current developments, there's a group called Uplift India Australia, which actuaries have been fairly significantly involved in. It's relevant to mention that in India, there is no public health financier like Medicare in Australia. Over 80% of health costs are paid directly out of pocket. The comparable figure in Australia is 15%. In many cases, for those living in poverty, they don't have the money. They need to go to a loan shark to pay for those things, and you get into that vicious spiral. So Uplift India Association is working as it's part of a network of NGOs, financial backing from the French government and an insurer called MACIF, very much developing a community-based funding model. So for those of you who read Kirsten Armstrong's paper, a few editions ago in Actuary Australia, it gave a pretty good profile, but it's very much around developing community-based health models where the community, in fact, is the one running the schemes. It's very locally based. They make decisions on claim payments, who warrants claim payments and so on. In terms of future work, there's groups such as Opportunity International, which Kirsten and myself are sort of mobilising a group of actuaries at the moment to be involved there. They're targeting a couple of particular regions in India which are particularly poor, and looking at linking up health providers with health insurers and product design and the like. Also a group called World Education, which is developing education material for the development of microfinance institutions. So that's a very quick scan of some of the developments occurring in that space. Again, it's very personally fulfilling, it's professionally challenging. Where it's really rewarding is the things happening in this space and the sorts of organisations that you deal with, they're very agile. They want to get on with it, they implement things quickly. So in a professional sense, that's where it's also very rewarding. Next example, couple of examples. Charles.
The next case study we're going to look at is about building, and I apologise for the typo, building regulatory capacity in Southeast Asia. I think it came out of the Asia crisis in the late 1990s when I guess the regulators in Southeast Asia countries realised that perhaps the regulation was needed a level of improvement, and the capital base for, say, many insurers was very weak. And they wanted to do something about it. In countries where you don't have a big experience base, it's very hard, and the only way of going forward is to look outside of the country for external help. And under the auspices of APEC, a very wide-ranging group was formed exactly with this purpose, to help regulators think through the issues and put in place better regulation for life insurance, essentially. And it was made up of people from the World Bank, IMF, Asia Development Bank, but also quite a wide range of actuaries were involved as well. The group used to meet for a couple of weeks at a time together, and it was very much sharing examples, discussing possible issues, technical issues, systemic issues, sharing common experiences, but obviously with an aim of letting the individual regulators form their own views on what they want and needed to do. It proved very successful. I believe it has continued to meet and provide support even well after, in many cases, regulations have changed in the countries and are moving towards, you know, current Western, perhaps, you know, European, American standards. And indeed, coming out of the example, I think the regulators are looking to pensions and banking for some of the same support. Another example that I was privileged to be directly involved in was really in New Zealand, an opportunity to be part of a very small team, essentially asked to solve a social problem, and that was the problem of emerging student debt. Coming out of the early 1990s, tertiary education became a user pays, or certainly part of the cost of tertiary education was user pays. Students could borrow from the state, but ended up with certain levels of debt, and over the years the amount of debt has grown and the issues of paying it off are seen to be quite severe social issues for younger people starting to establish families and households for themselves. The approach, the solution that we came up with, I perhaps would say this was a independent, in fact philanthropically supported, fairly light philanthropic support, but nevertheless it was supported sort of independent group, but we came up with the idea of developing a new national scale children's savings scheme. The idea was to work to find a way to allow children or families of children to save initially very, very small amounts of money towards tertiary education. Small amounts of money, way lower than the current financial services market was interested in dealing with. We're talking perhaps $2 a week, maybe. It was to be national scale, but independent of the government. New Zealand's size was such that we believed that really only a single organisation was warranted to do this. Operating very much in a not-for-profit mode with a very wide range of support from governments, from commercial institutions, from the community themselves as well. And in a way, perhaps, I mean, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. It was a little bit like some of the old post office savings accounts. It was designed to find a way to enable people to put money aside. It used asset-based welfare techniques so that we genuinely found ways that if, you know, on behalf of a child, say $2 could be saved, the wider family could find another $2 to back that. Through business, government, charitable support, we could find another $5 that would go in to match that original $2. And by doing that, we found ways of actually enabling children and young people by the age of 18 to have a pool of $12,000 to $15,000 towards their tertiary education. Tertiary education interpreted quite widely, definitely to include vocation as well. A feature of being in a not-for-profit is that it enabled commercial organisations to act very cooperatively to support it. An example being that all the major trading banks were prepared to offer transaction-based services completely gratis because they weren't competing with each other and they recognised the value. There was a lot of opportunity, a lot of interest from employers in providing extra benefits to their employees linked to saving towards their own children or a nominated child's account. We talked and found ways of cashing up loyalty programs so that you could put money towards your tertiary education rather than another toaster. So it was very widely involved. It didn't go ahead. There were political reasons for that, but that's so be it. The good news is that it has started to be adopted by smaller groups, so not national scale, but in New Zealand there are, for example, iwi groups that have their own relative levels of finances that they can put towards their own members, and they are starting to invest in the future education of their own people. In addition, some of the features have definitely appeared in the new New Zealand KiwiSaver scheme as well. We do touch on a number of examples, but we also wanted to find out more widely what level within the profession of activity in community service there might be. We undertook a survey in Australia. It was through the Pulse survey. In New Zealand, it was a sort of an email out to about 100 resident fellows with direct feedback, asking quite simple questions, not intended to be completely rigorous, but just provide an indication. And so the questions were really asking questions about involvement along the lines of that I mentioned in the previous slide. First question was, to what extent have you been involved in some form of actuarial contribution to public policy? And you can see in Australia there were 42% of people said yes to that. In New Zealand, 75%. I'll come back to an aspect of that in a second. Second question about involvement directly with not-for-profits or communities. Again there, 32% for Australia and 43% for New Zealand. Involvement using actuarial services with families and small groups, 39% and 64%. Then a slightly different question about to what extent have you done work with no remuneration, was 36% in Australia and 57% in New Zealand. I suspect the New Zealand higher levels in each case is not a feature of a greater level of altruism from the profession. When I actually had the opportunity to look at the individual respondents, I suspect that they were probably on average more experienced people, and of course it was a much smaller group of people that responded anyway, so there'll be natural deviation there. Underlying some of the responses, whilst there clearly is a bit of a core, the Australian group is quite tight, between about 32% to 42%, and so there's probably some evidence of a group of people being involved in things, which is fantastic to know about. When I looked at the New Zealand experience and trying to sort of see the patterns of individual responses, I came to a view myself that, in all honesty, there weren't many examples of individuals who were really doing what I would call a purer level of community involvement, if you like, quite away from their own current livelihood. Thank you.
Okay. Next section is just quickly going through a range of other sort of current initiatives and involvement. Micro insurance, I probably already covered that to a certain extent, so I won't dwell on that one too much. As I say, the next stages of development really are through, there's a group of us probably now about 10 or 12 actuaries looking at how we are engaged, especially through Opportunity International. And also there's a guy called Amon Kelly who was recently with CBA, who's gone up to India to take over from Francois Xavier Hay, working with the Uplift India program. So there's some good initiatives happening there. Huge issue in India. I mean, Andrew, I know you spent a bit of time the last few years in India, so you might want to comment later on, but broad statistics, you've got 860 million people living in poverty. That's less than $2 per day. So they've got a range of objectives in terms of lifting 5 million and then 10 million people out of poverty over the course of the next five to 7 years. So that's their social objective. More broadly, the World Bank is involved in quite a range of capacities as part of our research. We spoke to Rod Lester, who was actuary of the year back in 2005. Rod's doing some fantastic things around the globe, involved in some fascinating projects, disaster relief, setting up regulatory systems so the capital markets actually help people in terms of social equity. An area where they are fairly involved also is initiatives to do with community-based insurance mechanisms. There's a person in particular called Vijay, and hopefully I'll get the pronunciation right, Kalavakonda, and the development of microfinance and microinsurance mechanisms around the world. For example, for anybody interested, there's an opportunity at the moment in Rwanda, need for an actuary there for 2 or 3 months to work on developing a microfinance framework. My initial reaction when Rob mentioned that was, ooh, Rwanda. Didn't they have lots of unrest there a number of years ago? He said they obviously did, but he said he now feels safer in Rwanda than he does in the States. He said it's a fantastic place, settled down. He said that the whole governance of the place, he said 50% of the people running the government now are female, up from 10% years ago, and he said the place is run better than ever. So there's opportunities happening through the World Bank. They actually want to sponsor, in conjunction with the ILO, developing a textbook on microfinance and microinsurance, which I think would be good for us to contribute to. Some other emerging initiatives, you know, it's often the case that when people are involved in micro-enterprise development and micro-insurance, we think about people in need overseas, and there is a huge need. What about our own backyard? And if you think about the Australian context, we've got communities who are either living in poverty or in chronic social security dependent situations, and I feel that we've got a responsibility to do something about that. And the area where that's most apparent is with Indigenous communities. There are some developments on that front. In fact, ATSIC, the Australian Torres Strait Islander Commission, approached Opportunity International 5 or 6 years ago now. There have been some pilot programs been running, and they've now been running for sufficiently long to demonstrate that the results which can be achieved through microfinance and microenterprise development in Australia are achieving exactly the same sort of results which are being achieved overseas. 96% on-time repayment rates through microfinance, small loans, getting people up and running. So it can absolutely work in our context. I've had discussions with both some of the people in Opportunity International, but also an organisation called Many Rivers Opportunities. They basically want to do a rollout program around Australia. They want to work out how they go about it, site selection, etc. I think with some of the analysis that can contribute, we could help them. Next one I won't comment on too much, but there is an initiative which I've been involved in, which is actually getting a whole framework in place through the universities around philanthropy and social investment and how you can actually, if you like, educate people on how, whether you're on the giving or receiving side, how that can be done in a much more effective manner. One which probably is much better known in the profession is the involvement of actuaries in climate change and sustainability. I won't dwell on that too much because I think it is pretty well known. But Tony Coleman, Elaine Grace, probably sort of leading the charge for the profession on that, working, you know, the formation of the Australian Climate Change Group, shifting the position of the Business Council of Australia, which was then influential in shifting the position of the previous coalition government on some of the issues. Still lots more to be done, but that's an obvious area where actuaries can make a really valuable contribution. And I'm pleased to see Naomi Edwards is with us this afternoon. Naomi's been doing some fantastic work over the years in the area of forestry management and forestry protection, working in conjunction with the Conservation Foundation and making submissions and to Senate committees and the like. And without putting you on the spot, Naomi, if you feel... did you want to sort of expand upon that a little bit when we get to the discussion section? That would be great as well. So that's an overview of just some of the other areas of current endeavour. What we thought we'd start wrapping up, but just some brief thoughts. These are in the paper, but just touching on them lightly. Getting started, now, if you want to be involved in this area, how does one go about it? And none of this is rocket science. It's pretty basic, really. First issue really is identifying where are there issues or needs in the community and which ones of those issues or needs do you actually feel passionate about? I mean, if you're going to be involved in these areas, it's got to be something which aligns with your own areas of interest and passion. So finding those areas of alignment. In terms of going about it, I'm interested in hearing some of your case stories. Simple steps. Obviously, you know, go and do your research, talk to colleagues, certainly those who might be involved in the profession. But, you know, talk to people in the field. If you do your research and you come across names and you see initiatives, don't be reserved at all about just contacting people directly who are involved in those areas, finding out more, and if you want to get involved, offering your services. I mean, in many cases, people are, you know, welcome with open arms the fact that people, especially with some of our capability set, are prepared and want to make a contribution. They really absolutely welcome it. So if that means cold calling and speaking to people that you actually don't have a network contact with, just go for it. Best way is obviously just getting personally involved and volunteering your time and seeing how the role evolves. That will start broadening out in terms of organising friends and colleagues. And in many other cases, it might also, you know, express a view, whether that's making submissions to relevant government committees, letters to the editor, but it's basically sort of carving out a position of eminence, not for personal gratification, but so you can actually make a difference. We've also covered in the paper possible blueprint for action by the Institute, and this might be one of the discussion points about what should be the Institute's involvement be. Should it be a lead role? Should it be a lag role? A support role? Some of the areas which we thought about, Horizon sessions, either on pro bono work or specific initiatives happening in the community. Perhaps developing a guidance note to cover work which involves doing, you know, for the social good. For those, and I suppose this is especially for people who aren't necessarily working through a professional services organisation, perhaps a blanket PI cover arrangements for covering work in this space. Developing a data and research repository, so if we collect that information, and then especially if people wanting to find out which actuaries are involved in which initiatives, and we've got that repository available, we can help guide them in the right direction. And organising just activities for people involved in the NFP and non-government organisation sector to get together with actuaries. So there's a range of possible ideas in terms of possible roles for the Institute. I'll hand over to Charles to conclude.
There are some wonderful role models for the actuarial profession, and in our paper we want to raise the awareness of what's going on and encourage the opportunity to share some experiences about the work that's been done. We believe that there is a potential role for the Institute, something still to be discussed, but probably more facilitating-based role, keeping a register, making it easy for other people who are interested to make some initial contacts and find some initial actuaries that have perhaps had some experience in the area. There are undoubtedly some real and very valuable benefits to individuals who choose to get involved in this way, ranging from wider networks to leadership experience when you're working closer to the coalface to just the pure satisfaction of doing some of the things that you may be doing. And so what interests you? What concerns you? What we would like to do is encourage everyone to consider giving some of their time, getting involved, and then sharing the experiences with others. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Charles and Andrew. I'm sure you'll agree, very interesting and fascinating topic. I'd like to open up now to questions, comments, and particularly for people in the room who've had some other different experiences to share with us. Because this is being recorded, if you could use the microphone at the front, and please state your name before your comment. That would be great. Anthony.
Anthony Ashton, also Deloitte.
Okay, Anthony Ashton, it's a Deloitte thing. Thanks, Charles and Andrew. I think this is really helpful paper, and I think maybe we should think of something, a session in the professionalism course related to this, because I think it should be included in the educational system at some point. Just to briefly give a background of where I come from, just to explain what I'm going to say later. I spent 14 years as a university lecturer in South Africa, which I think is also one of the, it wasn't unpaid, but certainly was underpaid. And a very large proportion of the actuarial profession is noted for the extremely large proportion of people that are involved in education systems and in voluntary committees. So we actually are enormously generous of our time to the profession. And I think that should be recognized. While I was at the university, I was actually chairman of a microcredit lender and a social investment unit trust that invested using social criteria, which were two interesting areas, and spent a fair amount of time doing policy work. So I've touched on a lot of the issues that you've discussed over the years. I just wondered, as I think is the principle that one should take when entering into this thing, is actually take Jesus' second commandment, love your neighbor as yourself. It's actually very profound, and I think just four points to make on this. Loving yourself is very important before you love others. You have to respect yourself. A couple of examples of this, and the one is your what's in it for me, Andrew, which is a really good point. The point of this exercise is, in fact, to become matured, become whom you want to be, who you should be. It's actually really great. And if you're not extending yourself by it recognizing other people, you're not becoming mature. So it really is something that we should advance. This is not purely altruistic by any means. The second point is, though, is that there's a big risk of burnout. I have seen missionaries, I've seen people work with black South Africans, I've seen people work in Australia with Aboriginals in Australia who've gone in with the highest hopes and the greatest commitment and come out 10, 15, 20 years later burnt out and sore. Maybe still compassionate, maybe still generous, but actually having not failed to succeed. So in doing this, don't overspend. It's a long-term story. It's a 40, 50-year, it's a lifetime's adventure. It's not something to throw yourself into for three or four years and find you've exhausted your resources, you haven't looked after your family, you haven't looked after yourself, your super, and all the other stuff. It is important to look after yourself and love yourself so that you're in a position to understand what other people need for a real prosperous life. In fact, in another position, Jesus makes it very clear. You can't take something from your parents and give it to God. It's wrong. In fact, he calls it hypocrisy. So loving yourself is the first thing. Loving your neighbor is also important because it's the question. It's much easier to send tea bags to Africa than give a cup of tea to your neighbor because your neighbor's actually a rather unpleasant person. And you're likely to get it spilt in your face or thrown back in your face because that's the nature of getting to know people. It's complicated. So loving the person close to you is important in terms of really making a difference, really facing the issues. And the second part of that is actually the real risk when trying to do good to other people of the unintended consequences. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, and there are lots of really good stories about aid that has gone wrong. I can give you a number. I just would like to mention one which is really relevant to microinsurance, which is an issue. One of the organizations is recently attempting to set up funeral policies in South Africa. Funeral policies actually done a lot of damage in South Africa when provided by non-indigenous organizations. There are 10 million families in South Africa and probably 25 million funeral insurance policies that cover families. The children are overinsured. Life is cheap in South Africa. There are 8,000 deaths of children annually from accidents. If families are making profits from their funeral society, from funeral policies, there's a perverse incentive. The UK, in the 1845 Insurance Act in the UK, prevented payments of more than a couple of shillings for funerals for children. Because of the perverse incentives. I won't even say what happens. So there's that problem. The other problem is, of course, that the burial societies in South Africa were indigenous organizations that looked after their own. And the advantage was that people learned to keep accounts and run committees. When the insurance companies came in, they drove the informal burial societies out, which was a pity because the essence of development is literacy. And the start of literacy historically is accounting. So you want accounting at the start of... Anyway, I can go on about that one, but I would just like to summarize. If we're going to love our neighbors as ourselves, there are two things we should be, I think. The one is strategic. Think about really what a big difference we could make in the long run. Think 20 years, not 20 months. And the second is collaboration. And I think this is where this paper deserves really to be supported, and that collaborating with each other is much more fun and much more likely to be productive. Thank you.
Thank you very much for those interesting comments. Andrew.
Thanks, Andrew Wakeling. I might agree with everything that Anthony said, and I apologise for bringing the tone down a little. I would personally like to be helpful to the community. I've developed and sold far too many products that I wouldn't buy myself, and that's not as satisfying as it might be. I thought I'd just say a little bit about India, because actually there's a lot in this which is very straightforwardly commercial. If you want to go out and wear a loincloth and live with the starving poor, then you can do it. But it might be a bit more effective if you could actually get at the underlying economic forces. India. It's a fast-growing urban professional market. the international financial services groups salivate at the opportunity to get in there. They are all in somewhat mature markets, and their chief executives are desperately trying to raise their share prices, and they need to be able to sell the growth idea. And though, so those of us working in India or China or anywhere like that are basically selling the service of a growth premium. I have referred to it as we sell corporate Viagra. It can go down terribly well, but I think you know what I mean. Now, it isn't actually agreed in India that having international financial services groups in is a good idea. It's still unproven. They're not there. There's not open access for them. They're only allowed to have 26% share, and there are big restrictions on them. And the international financial services groups want that to be opened up. So it's really important for them that they are well regarded. Now, there's an underlying, unspoken but fairly obvious contract, which was basically from the Indian political establishment, we'll let you in and you can deal with our growing urban professionals, providing that you are useful to the poor. Because it really gives us a hell of a headache trying to work out how we're going to deal with all these people. We are running a democracy and we keep promising them health and security and all the rest of it. And damn it, we're not going to do it. So how about you doing it? Now, the International Financial Services Community said, yeah, fine, we can do it, no probs. Just let us in, let us in, let us in. And, I mean, I was part of going in, and we have done our best. There are quotas on us. We have to sell a certain number of products in to the rural areas and the socially disadvantaged groups, and we take this very seriously, and we have to report on it. But I hope you're not too surprised and not too disappointed to know that we attempt to do that in a way which is as easy as possible for us, costs us as little money, and it's not necessarily as socially useful as it might be. I actually managed to get a significant portion of our first quota by us actually sponsoring athletics carnivals. This meant that nobody who we insured was likely to be able to do the 15. They could all do the 1,500 metres in under 6 minutes. None of them were aged over 25. And the other thing is, in the pricing of this product, I actually realised that it was going to be cheaper for us to make it free rather than charging for it. And the underlying realisation was I think only about 15% of them knew that they'd got an insurance cover. We had no claims on it. No premium, no claims, and we sponsored an athletics carnival. Now, you might think that we could do better for the poor than that. So there are these rules, and actually the Rational International Financial Services Group executive needs to be very interested in anything that can be useful that they can attach their name to it. So if you've got some ideas, please, please go and camp out with the international groups and take money off them, because they should certainly be interested in supporting you, so you shouldn't have to sleep in the gutter. What can actually be done? Well, I actually believe the crucial thing is working with what's already there. A number of people think that selling universal life to poor people is doing good. I personally don't. I also don't think that actually variable life is a terribly good idea to people who are living on sort of $30 or $40 a month. It's wrong to actually believe that Indians haven't worked out how to do insurance. They have an enormous number of social support groups. These work under the radar of regulations, but they are in all the communities. Otherwise, they wouldn't have survived, because they have sickness and health and problems with supporting families and such like. And some of them are run really poorly. It would be really marvellous. If you work in India, you inevitably get to know some of these, and I didn't do anything like what I could have done and what I might hope to do. But it is just possible that we could perhaps form a partnership with some of these groups. I mean, there's a group of 2 million rural women in Kerala who run a social support arrangement. And they run it as best they can, but it wouldn't take much to help them, actually. So partnerships, visits, support or whatever could, I think, be enormously well
received. It would be better coming from a professional body than it would coming from an AIG or an Allianz or whatever. So there is considerable scope there. Working with them to improve their social groups is, I think, something that can be done relatively easily. It's to do with better record keeping. It's to do with more efficient ways of actually providing the benefits. I think there's an enormous amount to do. I think it could be enormously satisfying. But please, if you're going to do it, don't feel that you have to actually starve in the gutter. Go and take some money off the international service groups and sell to them the value of being associated with something worthwhile for a change. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Andrew. Some really interesting ideas and points there. And this Andrew. I mentioned earlier, Naomi, would you like to fill us in a little bit on...
I'm Naomi Edwards. As Andrew mentioned, work with quite a lot of NGO groups who are involved in the environment, so the Wilderness Society and so on. I guess my thing that I always just encourage people about is if you think there is an NGO group and you like what they do, a very direct approach to that group, saying that you'd like to be involved with them, even at quite a senior level, usually they'll be very excited and positive about. So even if you wanted to go straight into attending one of their strategy days when they're talking about what they want to do, or even joining their boards. I mean, obviously, with the really big NGOs, there is a lot of competition at board level, but as soon as you step down into the medium-tier companies, they often have a real lack of financial competence, even just around accounting and understanding their statements. And certainly with the environmental movements, there's a real asymmetry in their ability to get financial analysis. And all we're really talking about is... forecasting simple cash flows and doing net present valuations, for example. So often you've got a corporation or whatever saying, oh, let's do some bad environmental thing and it's really good, we'll make heaps of money. And then you've got the environmental group saying, oh, no, this is terrible for the environment. And so everyone kind of goes, well, sorry, but it's great financially, so you lose. And, of course, there's actually no one looked at the financial aspects from a different perspective. And so how I first got involved with this was I was asked to just work out, how much money was being made for some activity involving forestry. And I was really amazed because I looked in and I thought, oh, there's no money being made here. There's just really big government subsidies and corporate welfare. So that was sort of a big surprise to everyone. And, of course, no one had ever looked at it from that perspective before. So often they just need... someone, helping them with their situation. And, of course, the closer you are to it, the better, the more kind of passionate you feel about doing work. But it's usually just simple spreadsheet stuff and you just have to be confident to make up some assumptions and stuff, because when other people are going, oh, well, if we, stick in this dam or whatever, we'll get a 15% compound IRR or whatever, they're just making up assumptions too, the World Bank has shown that, usually big developers forecast IRRs on these projects are at least 50% overstated compared to the eventual project benefits. So that's really easy to do, and I can't imagine that they would rebuff you. And if you ever got rebuffed, then just go to a different group or higher up. I guess there was a list there of things that Colin Priest recommended in 2004. They're all really fantastic suggestions, and none of them have really happened, and that's really disappointing to me. The main target of most of my research has been a company in Australia called Guns Limited, And basically, for some reason, I'm kind of the only person that hasn't been sued yet by Gunns, but they're the most litigious company. And, of course, I have no insurance and I own all my assets. And so, you know, my house is constantly, you know, under the gun with every paper I do. So I just did another paper, you know, no insurance. Gunns tend to sue everyone. So the provision of some kind of blanket insurance cover for those of us who do pro bono work and have no income would be fantastic. And the Institute used to have it. Maybe it was prohibitive during the professional indemnity explosion of costs, but, you know, now premiums are coming down a bit. It would be a great thing to have. Well, I think that after 4 years of writing papers about Gunns and not being sued yet, hopefully I'm off the radar for some reason. They tend to pick on small guys they think wouldn't fight back, so... But all of those things that the... So I just encourage you, if you've got a charity, you know, maybe the Smith Foundation or something working locally to your area, they would love to have any advice you can give them, because they're often negotiating with governments around areas. So the more knowledge they can have on their side to do financial modelling of whatever argument they're putting to government, you know, we think that poor people should have access to this, but they don't have financial forecasts. So you could do that for them. They would really love that. Thanks.
Thank you. It's really interesting.
Thanks a lot, Naomi, and I think most of you are aware Naomi's been doing just fantastic work in that area. Just one additional comment to make on that, and I think I'm correct in saying, Naomi, that part of what you've brought to bear there, and probably goes back to a paper you wrote a number of years ago, was on sort of valuing biodiversity and some of those intangible benefits. So I think that principle is extendable, that in some other areas, like if it is getting involved with charitable organisations in whatever capacity they're involved in, and if the main benefit they're bringing is some sort of social good, then the issue always arises, you know, how do you actually quantify what is that social good, which has probably been part of the example in the forestry case. And the Institute is actually involved in another group which started happening a few years ago called the Society for Knowledge Economics. But essentially that the genesis for the formation of the Society of Knowledge Economics was to get a much better understanding around intangibles. Even in the corporate world, 60% of value creation these days is actually intangible. If you think about brands or distribution or customer franchises or whatever it is, 60% of value creation these days is intangible. In many of these cases, working in the community, and if it's working with some of these organisations, the benefits side of the equation as opposed to the cost side of the equation is going to be intangible. And I think what Naomi has demonstrated, for example, is the value that we can bring around the valuation of intangibles to help them pursue their particular causes.
Almost out of time, I think, unless there's any final points from the room at all.
Andrew Gower, I just want to bring about an experience that I had 2 days ago. It's not in actuarial work and it's not using my actuarial skill set at all, but I joined a community music group a year ago. And 2 days ago, we did a concert with the Choir of Hard Knocks, and we absolutely brought the house down, and it was probably one of the biggest highs I've ever had in my life, to see what Jonathan Welsh has done with the Choir of Hard Knocks, and that's happened in about 20 months. They've got an ARIA award, they've won a Logie. Small things can build up very quickly, and that's a great example. Might not be in the actuarial area, but go out there and do something and you get a mammoth high. I came off stage on Sunday afternoon and there were audience members who were crying and everything else because of the emotion that they'd heard, and it was just such a good high to feel it for me, in that I was helping these people and they were getting something out of it as well. So
thank you. I think Calvin...
My comment's a little bit more mundane than that. I'm Kelvin Prisk. A couple of years ago, I wasn't working. I was doing a bit of work, writing papers for government, making submissions on all sorts of strange things because they were trying to develop this thing called KiwiSaver. But an interesting job went by. Not many people saw it. I finished up working as an Australian aid worker in PNG. I'm still in PNG some of the time, but I'm now getting paid directly by the central bank up there. I went up there basically to be an expert on insurance matters, and I finished up doing a whole lot of work for them on superannuation. But it was just one of these strange jobs that went by. And just so what I say is there's all sorts of opportunities out there that go by from time to time. They're not necessarily a lifetime commitment. This was a one-year contract, and of the sort of people who were up there, there's quite an interesting bunch of people working in Port Moresby, and on the intake that I was in, there was a young economist from Western Australia who was going up there to do some work with the, what do they call it, the support group for the cabinet up there. He's now, having spent about 18 months there, he's now got himself into London School of Economics, and his aid work is now funding development of his career. And it was an ideal opportunity for someone at that age to branch out and do something different, try something completely different. I think he and his partner have grown immensely from challenging themselves in this manner. I think they're going to find a different set of challenges when they go to London. But all I say is there are opportunities out there. Sure, you don't get paid as well as you might do, and it might not fit into your career expectations as you thought it might have done, but geez, you learn a lot about yourself and you meet some very interesting people.
I'm not even sure that you're aware of this, that the task force for care costs, you know, with the childcare rebates went up to 50%. Hewitt participated in that and so did Swiss Re. We actually developed the model and did the pricing for that. And that didn't take much time. It was really just a month or two. We just did a bit of stuff on the side and off we go. And that's my contribution. It's not quite as community-oriented as this, but it is helping people who care. And it doesn't have to be the biggest thing in the world. But I think if we can have some small groups just getting together and doing some things, that's a way forward from where we are.
Take on naming, you take on all of us. They do naming, but I do name. Everyone in your area of service is second.
Thanks, Narajo. Thank you. Well, we've had some great information and great sharing coming out this afternoon, and hopefully some action will come out of this as well. So please join me to thank very much indeed Andrew and Charles.